Hey folks, we have some exciting news to tell y'all about. The Bad Rollin' Project has partnered with Expedition 44 and Rival Nations to start the one-of-a-kind No Key But Christ Network. This network will consist of content creators with the focus of Jesus as King and no other. For more information, visit NoKeyButChristNetwork.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome to the Bad Roman Podcast. On this show, we talk with veterans, community leaders, Christians, and non-Christians as we explore the entanglement of Christians with the state. The Bad Roman Project was created out of the firm belief that as Christians, we are called to follow Christ, not the state. Here is your host, Craig Hargis.
Hey, folks. I have been intrigued with the Anabaptists for almost the entire time of the Bad Roman Project. I've often thought that they are as close to the No Key But Christ as we will get when it comes to modern Christianity, but how much do we really know about their history? Are they like early church fathers such as Tertullian, or are there differences? Cody Cook comes back on the show to discuss this and his new book, The Anarchist Anabaptist.
Let's go. Yeah.
Left, right, left, right, left.
We got our
right,
marching orders, man.
Left, right, left, right.
We'd rather
left,
serve God than
right,
serve Caesar, you
left,
feel me?
Right.
Cody, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me back, Craig. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. I've been really interested to talk to you about this because, like I said in the intro, there's something that the Anabaptists have been so I've been really curious about them. I knew something back in the day whenever I was going to Southern Baptist churches back in Northwest Arkansas. They would kind of visit our church if they could, you know, if they couldn't find a church. And they would kind of go, but I remember them calling themselves Mennonites. You know, so you got Mennonites and Anabaptists and the Amish. I think they're all kind of connected somehow, if I'm understanding the history correctly about that. But I don't want to get too far into that yet, because I'd like to get just kind of catch up with you a little bit and see how you've been. You know, it's been a while since you've been on the show, and what's going on with Cody these days?
Yeah, well, I think part of what brought you on here is some of what I've been working on, which is a couple different books, actually. You've read an advanced copy of one of them, or advanced draft of one of them. But both of them deal with Anabaptism. So one is that I'm working on is kind of like a pocket systematic theology from an Anabaptist perspective. But it's a little bit different than a regular systematic theology, because it's kind of a historical systematic theology. In that I'm really sort of looking at kind of arranging content the systematic way, but then saying, what did early Anabaptists say about these issues? How did early Anabaptist confessions deal with the Trinity? Or what might, an early Anabaptist leader like Menno Simons have said about, you know, soteriology or salvation. So that's one project. The other one is a book that for now is titled The Anarchist Anabaptist, and I hope we keep that title because I like it. And that's one I'm in talks to maybe have it published by a publisher, but that's not official yet. So for the moment, the publication date is TBD. But I'm happy to talk about either one of those things. I think mostly we're going to be focusing on the anarchist Anabaptist stuff today. But that's been keeping me busy, just kind of doing some deep dive research into these early movements and their viewpoints. Because one thing Anabaptists tend to not really write are systematic theologies. So I wanted to lay out their views a little bit more systematically. And then in the Anarchist Anabaptist, I'm sort of exploring where I think their political theology logically leads to, which is that kind of Christian anarchist tradition. So that's kind of what I've been doing. Other than that, just I've been doing some more stuff at the Libertarian Christian Institute, which I know you've got a couple friends over there. So that kind of stuff's been keeping me busy.
Yeah, it sounds like you've been very busy, but you're doing some good work, you know, writing and doing some study and some research. I think that's very important too. I'm kind of jealous of you, actually, because my work keeps me tied up from doing a whole lot of other things anyway. But I think that's neat.
I know you were telling me about your work schedule the other day. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty insane right now. They're not approving any time off, but I'm thankful I was off this week, and I'm cramming 3 podcasts in this weekend because I knew I was going to be off to get them recorded, because I don't know when I'm going to get another day off.
Well, good luck to you. I hope everybody shows up.
Yeah. All right. So let's start here, because I think, like I said in the intro, the Anabaptists have been very intriguing to me for a long time. And kind of like you, my reading of early church writings and, you know, early church fathers and the history of the church kind of pointed me towards Anabaptists. If I wanted to find something that was close to the way they were, it seemed like I was always being directed towards Anabaptists. And so I wanted to know more about them. And I've done a little bit of study on them, but I've searched for an Anabaptist church or something or the like in the Memphis area. And it just doesn't exist. Now there's one about an hour and a half away in Mississippi, which is, it's tough enough for me to do to get up Sunday morning to go to church, because if I'm working till 4 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, you know what I'm saying? So driving another hour, hour and a half to get to church, getting up early enough to do that that's not happening. And I think I'm okay with Jesus with that too.
Yeah. And the thing too is, even that one that's farther away, there's a lot of derivations, you know, with kind of where Anabaptists are today. So you have the very conservative who tend to be very theologically conservative. And sometimes if they do vote, they'll probably vote Republican. And then you have the kind of the liberal Mennonites, which there are some within about 30 or 40 miles from me, who are very theologically liberal and are very also likely, I think, to vote Democrat. And so, you know, that's one thing I kind of noticed was that there's this, I think, rich tradition of where the early Anabaptists were. Of this kind of political theology that is tended to be very sort of separate from the state and from politics, insofar as they did have a political theology or speak to what the kind of the political world, they really, I think, preceded what ended up coming out of that, the sort of the early kind of classical liberal and libertarian and into the anarchist movements, where you, I think, really had, this emphasis on freedom of religion, freedom of speech, voluntary relationships. Anabaptists were really in a large way trying to build a voluntary society. And that was such a strange idea at the time. I mean, even the Protestants weren't really interested in doing that. They just wanted to create a new kind of religious state, a new kind of Christian nationalism. And so, you know, I think part of what I'm trying to do is to kind of present a traditional Anabaptist viewpoint that has a high view of scripture and that really takes seriously their kind of bona fides on some of these sort of on kind of political theology, instead of saying, okay, well, you know, if we are going to vote or we are going to be involved, let's just become Republicans or become Democrats. I think there's a much better way forward that we can see in that Anabaptist movement by looking backwards. So there's a danger, I think, you know, you might get really excited about this church an hour and a half away and visit, and then everybody there could, you know, have Kamala Harris bumper stickers on their on their car.
Well, it's funny because I remember I actually talked to the pastor through email. When I started looking into it, it was back in 2020. It's been a long time since I've talked to him. And it was during kind of the COVID stuff. Maybe it's 2021 or 2022. We're kind of coming out of some of that stuff, some of the restrictions, you know, like the mask wearing and them shutting down churches and stuff. And I told him my opposition to wear a mask. Mainly, I don't care if somebody else does it, but I just can't do it because of my claustrophobia. That was one of those. That was a no-go for me. And I was worried about showing up to the church and they'll tell me you can't come in without a mask on. And he said, no, we said, we don't do that here. So they weren't following mask mandates, but it's in Mississippi. It might be different in a different state. I don't know how hardcore Mississippi was enforcing these mandates or not, but he said some people do. He said their biggest concern was for the elderly. They didn't want them getting sick. So they were really careful about that. But he said that was not something I shouldn't worry about that if I wouldn't come visit them. And then, like I said earlier, it just got so difficult to try to get up to go drive, make an hour and a half drive to go to church, you know? So you're talking about a 3-hour round trip after 2 or 3 hours of sleep. And that's a cranky Craig. I promise you.
Yeah. You wouldn't seem that past peace loving when you got there.
I would not be. Yeah. I mean, I've been nice to their face, but I've been griping at every driver on the way home. I promise you.
Yeah.
Especially in this area. With your study of the Anabaptist history, we're going to get into the history of the Anabaptists here shortly, but with your study, you're seeing this is kind of what drew you. It sounds like drew you towards them as well, do you see them as like, all right, if they're not anarchists, they could be anarchists at some point if you kind of had time to sit down and talk with them, because they kind of have these anarchist leanings.
Yeah, I mean, so it also kind of depends on how you define anarchist. So one way I'll divide anarchism is a kind of separationist anarchism and then an activist anarchism. And so traditional Anabaptists, I think, fall pretty neatly into that separation anarchism idea, in that they're not necessarily going to fight to overthrow the state. But for them, Christ is their king. They're going to try to obey the laws and be respectful But ultimately, they see themselves as under Christ rule, and the world is under, outside of the perfection of Christ. And so the state is kind of this means by which the pagans kind of regulate themselves. You know, they're not going to necessarily fight or protest to overthrow the state or anything like that. But it just doesn't, it's not really a feature for them. It's not something that matters to their lives. And so that's the kind of separation type anarchism. Whereas I think those who, kind of traditional, like libertarian activists are more on that activist side, right? We can go into this a little bit, but that doesn't mean that the early Anabaptists had nothing to say to the state, that they never petitioned the state or never said anything to leaders about, the right and wrong ways for them to do their jobs, or sort of spoke to them about kind of war profiteering or oppressing Christians or innocent people. It's just that, for the most part, they just, they wanted to live their lives and sort of, in a way, I think maybe a parallel could be kind of like agorism today, where, you sort of live in your own kind of separate voluntary community, and you're just kind of distinct from what the world is doing. So that's kind of the traditional Anabaptist way of doing it, which I do think counts as a kind of anarchism.
Yeah. And see, that's another thing too, with the label anarchist. It's one of those things, and I've said it over and over, that just, I don't think I really care about being labeled that anymore, because it does, you don't really know what it means anymore, because there's a lot of people call themselves anarchists that I disagree with on their anarchy, it's just, but I'm not going to be one of those two. It's like, you're not an anarchist or you're not a real anarchist. I'm not going to be one of those types either. I just, if it's something that's confusing to me or doesn't seem consistent to me, then I'm not interested in it. So there's a lot of inconsistencies when it comes to anarchy and stuff. And I think that's why I just kind of just get back to the teachings of Christ. And if that's makes me look like an anarchist, then I guess I'm an anarchist. But I just prefer to be called a Christian. And even sometimes there's a lot of things that come along with that too, because there's a lot of hateful Christians out there as well. So you just got to live a life, and hopefully it gets people to ask you questions of why you're living the way you're living, and go from there.
Yeah, labels are useful, but they can also be misleading. So you have to be ready to explain yourself.
100%. Yeah. All right. Do you want to? You kind of touched on a little bit during all that with the history of the Anabaptists, but kind of how much study have you done on the early Anabaptists and where they kind of came out of? Because like I said earlier, you got the Mennonites, the Amish, and the Anabaptists. They all kind of seem connected. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like they're all kind of offshoots of one, or two of them offshoots of the Anabaptists, or is it Anabaptists offshoots of the Amish? And I may be wrong, but I feel like I read this somewhere, like the Amish didn't really start till they got to America.
Yeah. So here's kind of the short of it, I guess. So basically from the time that Christianity became the official state religion of Rome, under Theodosius I in 391 AD, up until about the 16th century, the Protestant Reformation, the Christian church was largely, I think, united in its acceptance that the church has to be propped up by the force of government, that church and state have to work together in some way to build a Christian society, and that has to be maintained by the threat of force. And you really don't see that trend challenged significantly. There may be some splinter groups that did, but you don't see it challenged significantly until the 16th century. It wasn't challenged by the Protestants. It wasn't challenged by Luther or Calvin or Zwingli. It was challenged by a group of radicals that were called the Anabaptists. And the word Anabaptist means to rebaptize or to baptize again. There was some diversity early on. There were a handful that even were okay with violence until they sort of coalesced around, I think, some key ideas that became sort of benchmarks of what Anabaptism means. And those ideas were the baptism of sincere believers. Ultimately, they felt that baptizing infants didn't really do anything, that it didn't really serve the purpose of the church either. But the reason why that was so important to the Catholics and the Protestants was because they were interested in creating a Christian society. And so if you're baptizing the infants, you baptize them into the church. So every member of society, everyone who's born, is also part of the church. And so baptism, infant baptism, was really a means by which the state could basically call everybody who was under it part of the church and part of the state. So Anabaptists challenged that idea. They held to believers' baptism, which was seen as, I think Calvin actually referred to them as anarchists because of that belief. They held to nonviolence. Like I said, early on, there were a few that didn't. There was a rebellion where they took over, some Anabaptists took over the city of Munster. And even those, interestingly enough, they believed in nonviolence in kind of prior to the end of the age. But the problem was that some of them were very, at least the Munsterites were like, had this kind of overrealized eschatology. So they thought that basically, yes, we're supposed to be nonviolent until the end of the age, but the end of the age has now come. So we have to take over the city of Munster and welcome Jesus back. But so anyway, that of course failed horribly. And so after that, I don't think there were any Anabaptists that were pro-violence. They coalesced around nonviolence. And they also held to separation from the state, particularly its violent functions. There's a little bit of diversity there to some extent. So there was a guy named Balthasar Hubmaier who was trying to kind of build sort of like a Christian state, who believed in believer's baptism. But even he kind of looked at the function of government a little bit more like a modern American would, in the sense that he didn't think that it was right to force religion on people. So he was kind of in the middle there. And then you had a guy named Pilgrim Marpeck, and he was okay with participating in the nonviolent functions of government. So I think he actually worked as like an engineer who served his local city, and he was okay with that, but he just didn't think that Christians should participate in the violent functions. So there's a little bit of a gradation. And I think you and I have even had some conversations about this, like where exactly you draw that line. I think I'm a little bit more in the middle, where I think you're kind of more on the kind of heavy separation side. And the Anabaptists reflected those same kind of diversity of opinion. The other thing that I think sort of made them stand out was they held to living simply together in community. And so those were the things that sort of made the Anabaptists unique. Now, their origin is often dated to January 21st, 1525, which was the day when two of Zwingli's followers baptized each other illegally. They were sort of dissatisfied because it seemed like Zwingli was going to go along with kind of trying to create a free church. Then he gets involved in the city council, and so he starts compromising all over the place, and they want to move forward. So they baptized each other, and Zwingli basically asked for their heads. So over time, you have the Anabaptists separating into different communities. So early on, you have groups like the Mennonites and the Hutterites. The Hutterites believed in sort of shared property, like communal property. But of course, it was all voluntary. You voluntarily gave up your property and agreed to share it. There's no violence going on there. And then from the Mennonites, the Amish split off, and they do start off in Europe, although as we know them today, it's more of an American phenomenon. Then you sort of have groups like the Church of the Brethren. The Hutterites are still around. There were some in America, but they left. Most of them left during World War I, I think, because of the draft. And so many of them went to Canada. And so you see a lot more Amish in America and a lot more Hutterites in Canada. But generally speaking, if you meet an Anabaptist, they're going to value believer's baptism. They're not going to practice infant baptism. They're going to value nonviolence. They're going to value separation from the world and the state. Although, as I mentioned, you're going to find some exceptions where you're going to find conservative Mennonites and Amish who might vote for Trump, and some progressive Mennonites who may vote Democrat. But generally speaking, they're at least going to pay lip service to that tradition of separation and nonviolence, and you know, they're going to at least lean into that a little bit more than you like a Southern Baptist would.
Right. So, yeah, and I remember right before the election too, I don't know if this picture was real, but it was a bunch of Amish carrying around Trump signs. And I don't know if it was a real photo or not, but somebody posted it in the, it might've been Chris Polk, but put it in the discussion group, the Bad Roman discussion group. And my first thought was, and I commented, I said, if the Amish are voting and supporting Trump, I said, the world is, it's almost over. We're coming to an end now. If he's able to persuade them to vote for him, Jesus is about to come back. You know, it's funny too, because I've got about 10 or 15 miles down the road from where I live, there's a little Amish community. They may be more Mennonite than Amish. They've got a little cafe out there. They're not as secluded, you know, from society like you see a lot of the Amish are. So they're very welcoming. You go to their shop, they got a bunch of homemade food, homemade canned food and stuff, and some of the Amish cheese is delicious. So I don't know if you've ever had any Amish cheese, but it's delicious. But they got some of the best food too. I sat down, and they seem to be some of the happiest people too. Like they were all working in a hot kitchen, wearing too many clothes to be wearing it, and working in a hot kitchen during the middle of summer in Memphis, you know, outside of Memphis, because it gets hot here. But they just seemed so happy. And like I said, I sat down and had a corned beef sandwich they made. It was delicious. You know, they're just the nicest folks, you know. So I've always just found been very intrigued by them. I'm very interested in them. But I don't know if it's, you know, now that I think about it, they've got a little church out there. And I talked to them. I said, can anybody just come to church out there? And they said, yeah, all are welcome. You know, where the Amish, I think you kind of got to be a part of like their close-knit community to participate in their church. And I don't know if that's true or not. That's why I think they're a little different than the Amish. So that's why I think they might be more Mennonite than Amish.
And there's variation within the Mennonites, but even among the Amish, there are variation. Some go a little bit more liberal when it comes to how much technology they'll allow or that kind of stuff. But
for real. Yeah. And so the book, The Anarchist Anabaptist, and hopefully the, you know, the title sticks, because I like it as well.
Thanks.
I think the two kind of go together. I think anarchist and Christianity go together. If you understand the truth, sense of anarchy, not what you're hearing from people who have no idea where they, or they get their information from Sean Hannity, so, or Donald Trump. So, but I think the two kind of go together. That's why I've been kind of drawn to them a little bit.
Yeah. What I would say is, I mean, you know, I think we both have libertarian friends and, you know, anarchist friends who come from different traditions, Lutheran, Reformed, you know, Methodist, whatever. I think, what you're going to find in Anabaptism for them is a much surer, that's a hard word to say, foundation for their theology, for and for their political theology, especially in Anabaptism, than you're going to find in like Lutheranism or Reformed Christianity or even Catholicism. And so that's kind of one thing I'm trying to do with this book is I'm first of all trying to persuade Anabaptists to, I think, follow the logic of their own position into what came later, anarchism, and particularly Christian anarchism. But I'm also asking anarchists who are Christians and libertarians who are Christians to really give Anabaptism a look, because, you know, there's much more, I think, a home in Anabaptism for that kind of thought, at least in how it's been traditionally understood, than you're going to find. There's not a lot of resources in Reformed or Catholic or Protestant theology for that kind of thinking. But I think you're going to find a lot of resources for it in Anabaptism.
I agree. Hey, folks. Do you like salsa? I love salsa. I have come up with a fire recipe, and we have been shipping this homemade salsa all across the country. If you like salsa and want a cool way to support the project and spread the message of no king but Christ, then holler at us. You can reach us at badromansalsa@gmail.com or visit the official Bad Roman Salsa Facebook page and message us there. Thank y'all so much for your continued support. Now let's get back to the show. And I think, too, because I was going to save this towards the end, but maybe since you're kind of segueing into it, then we'll jump back into like ANCAPs and the NAP and rejection of pacifism, but we're kind of talking about it now. So you said something about the Reformers. What separated the Anabaptists from the Reformers or the Reformation? Because there's a history, there's a long history of this, where there was a lot of violence being done to the Anabaptists from the Reformers. And it's something that I cannot, whenever I bring it up, and this is not me trying to throw darts or daggers at anybody that we know in these circles who are Calvinist or Lutheran. That's not what I'm trying to do. What I'm trying to, I want an honest discussion with somebody about this, because I can't pin any of them down on it. You may have been able to in the past because you know some of the same people, but I haven't. No, you know, maybe it's because I'm not, I don't, maybe I come at them a little too strong, where you're a little more, you could talk to people a little bit better than I can when it comes to like this, but they won't. I can't get them to talk to me about it. And I don't understand why they just kind of, they kind of gloss over all that happening. Now, maybe they just know that was just a bad part of it and we've moved on from it, but it's, I still like to talk about it. So maybe you can help me out here a little bit.
Yeah. The Protestants are sort of known for, in theory, being the sola scriptura people, the scripture alone people. You know, they follow that humanistic tradition, ad fontes, back to the sources, and also always reforming based on the Bible. But unfortunately, I don't really see that in what the early reformers were doing. I think they basically, you know, turned the bus around and went back as far as Augustine and said, this will do. I think the Anabaptists, what were really interested in doing was, I think, figuring out how to live according to the principles that Jesus was announcing. So, and in particular, they put a lot of emphasis on the Sermon on the Mount, because they feel like in the Sermon on the Mount, they have their ethical guidelines, they have their marching orders, they're sort of being told how to live and what to value. And so that was, I think, really important for them. You know, ultimately, the Anabaptists were seen as part of what was called the Radical Reformation, which means extreme in common parlance, but it also means basically to go back to the original sources. Basically, to be radical means to go back to the beginning. And I think that's really what they did more so than Protestants were willing to do. You know, so at the time, 16th century, you have this increasing violence between Catholics and Protestants. You have that the word Protestant actually comes not from theologians, but from princes, from political forces that were seeking to shake off Roman Catholicism and shake off the power of the Pope. You not really have any authority over them, ultimately. And so they called themselves Protestants. They were protesting the power of the Pope so that they could create a different kind of state. And so you have, you know, Catholics in their territory who are persecuting Protestants, Protestants in their territory that are persecuting Catholics. And Anabaptists had the distinction of being oppressed and martyred by both groups. And ultimately, the reason why is because they challenged the foundation of Christendom, and Christendom being the interrelation of church and state, which both Roman Catholics and Protestants supported. And here's how they did that. So the first thing is that they taught the baptism of believers only. There's an Anabaptist church historian, Walter Klassen, and he noted that, this is a quote, "Roman Christianity had long assumed the validity of the Volkskirche. That is, that with the exception of heretics and Jews, everyone in Europe belonged to the church, the people's church, by virtue of infant baptism." So, end quote. So even though Protestantism challenged the supremacy of the Roman Catholic magisterium, it still affirmed a form of their view of church and state relationships, where basically each country has an official faith and all the citizens are assumed to be adherents. In contrast, Anabaptists saw the church as, this is Klassen again, quote, "the gathered congregation of believers who have voluntarily entered it by baptism upon confession of faith," end quote. And this is an important distinction. You may have heard people talk about the visible versus the invisible church before. Well, I always thought the visible versus the invisible church was, the visible church are the people who claim to be Christian in a, you know, democratic society, thinking it from that perspective. And the invisible church are the people who maybe are really saved because maybe some of the people that claim to be saved are faking it or whatever. But really that distinction emerges from Protestantism, and it was a way of saying, well, of course, everybody's part of the visible church because everybody in the state, apart from Jews, is a member of the church. So that's the visible church, those who are forced to pretend to be Christians. And the invisible church are those who are really Christians. And Anabaptists basically had no time for that kind of distinction. They said, if you're here, you need to be sincere. And if you're not sincere, then leave. So, you know, in Reformed and Catholic thought, baptism, of course, it is the cement that's holding secular society together. And the Anabaptists, I think, are following the early church emphasis, which distinguished the church from the world and saw baptism as a rite which formally marked a transition from the world into the kingdom of God.
We all make plans for the future, like car accidents, break-ins, and unexpected fires. Can disrupt those plans. At Shelter Insurance, our agents help design insurance plans that work for you and help protect what matters most. Shelter Insurance ranked number one for auto insurance in the Forbes 2024 World's Best Insurance Company survey. Shelter Insurance. We're your shield. We're your shelter.
That's not the way Catholics thought of it. It's not the way Protestants thought of it. It is the way Anabaptists thought of it. Now, some Protestants today think of it that way, and they're not going to give Anabaptists the credit for that because they received it from secular liberal tradition. But the Anabaptists were ahead of that. Okay, so I talked for a long time there. I was emphasizing, I think I was going to mention three things that made the Anabaptists stand out. The second one, I mean, we kind of talked about, I'm kind of repeating myself a little bit, but because they are part of a different kingdom, they emphasize a different way of life and a different kind of citizenship. They're called to obey God rather than men. And then the third thing was that they had an obedience to God, an allegiance to his kingdom, and that included the rejection of violent force. Jesus not only modeled nonviolent love toward his enemies, but he commanded it from his followers as well. And that made them stand out from the Protestants. And really, I guess there may be one more thing I can emphasize, which is that they did not they believed in free will. So, and I think it's interesting to point out all of these things that they're talking about all have to do with having a voluntary faith. You don't baptize babies because they can't consent. You don't kill heretics because that's wrong. They're not consenting to that. You want to have a church of people who actually believe because it's important that you consent. And even that emphasis on consent and a voluntary faith even goes back to their belief that humans have free will and that God has not chosen who is going to be saved and damned as individuals from the beginning of time. That emphasis on a voluntary faith and a voluntary religion and on consent, I think, is what makes them really stand out, because everything kind of flows from that.
All right. There's a couple points that I want to touch on that you said, and I think the first one is very important because it's something that I've noticed too. As you said, that they kind of go back to Augustine and said that's good enough. And I think you're doing yourself a disservice by stopping at Augustine, because there's so much church history prior to Augustine that they're missing out on. You know, you could go read stuff like from Polycarp. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he, by all accounts, was taught by the Apostle John. So why would we not want to take some of his writings and they look into this stuff? Because I've always been kind of fascinated. Well, maybe not always, but bigger portion of my life I've been fascinated by history. I don't really get into like fantasy type writings, but like the history of stuff and where they came from. And that's why I was drawn to the early church, because the history and just seeing how they interacted with the Roman Empire. But I think you're right. I think that they didn't go back far enough. And then we've mentioned this on the show before with Keith Giles. I think it may have been him or somebody else I've had on the show that said they just don't go back far enough. And I think they're doing themselves a disservice. And I'm not trying to throw daggers at anybody. Do what you want to do. But I think that if you went back further, you might see some differences along the way that might help shape the way you view the Anabaptists or view early church history.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's a Lutheran who's listening right now who says, "Hey, I read Polycarp and I read Ignatius." I'm being a little bit doing something sort of rhetorical here when I say that they sort of said Augustine's good enough.
Well, I think it's right though. I'm
sort of overstating the case, but there's also some truth in what I'm saying. Yeah.
Let's jump into anarcho-capitalism and how they reject pacifism, but they hold to the nap. And it's not just Calvinist or even Lutherans when it comes to like self-defense when it comes to pacifism. I've had these discussions over and over and over for the past 5 years, it seems like. It's one of the main topics that comes up in these circles is pacifism. That I think that's another thing about the Anabaptists that I was drawn to, was their idea of pacifism and holding to that. Now, what is it about, what do you think it is about pacifism that they're rejecting? By all accounts, it looks to me like Jesus would condone pacifism, because to me, Jesus was a pacifist. Okay. But then they'll bring up things like Jesus flipping over tables and whipping people, which wasn't true. He never struck anybody with a whip. We've had this conversation on the show with Jason Porterfield where it was part of his book. Then he talks about the whip that Jesus was using is basically just to direct sheep. It wasn't even hitting the animals in these temples, you know. So
yeah, I think it makes the argument it was sort of like a collection of straw, right? That it was sort of,
he actually ordered the material off of Amazon and made his own whip, and he said his kids were laughing at him and said, "That's not a whip." Mm-hmm. But that's what Jesus was using to drive out the animals of this temple, you know. And it's just one of those things that people will jump to. Is like, well, Jesus, when you talk about self-defense, and I've had this conversation in person with some of these folks about it, I said, he never hit anybody with that whip. But if you're going to use that as an example of Jesus not being a pacifist, you need to really go see what was actually happening that day. But what do you think it is about pacifism that they have such an issue with?
Anarcho-capitalists?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think they would argue, and I actually don't think Anabaptists would disagree with them on this point, that you have a natural right to self-defense. And so when you tell somebody that you don't have a right to self-defense, they say, well, somebody wants to hurt me or violate me, I don't have a right to respond to that. I don't have a right to defend myself. And I think you do. You do have a natural right to defend yourself. The question is, if you're a follower of Jesus, what are your obligations to Jesus? Because Jesus is not really in the rights business. Jesus is not into telling his followers, all of their rights and how everybody needs to back off. And, you know, if somebody, you know, steps on your foot, you step on their foot back. If somebody breaks your glass, I mean, Jesus is all about saying, set aside your rights. You know, like you have a right to the money that you earn, right? You have a natural right to it. But Jesus also tells you how you're supposed to spend it. And so if you're going to be a follower of Jesus, you set those rights aside. That's one point that I make in the book, where I sort of look at the way that there are perhaps potential tensions between Anabaptism and anarchism. And I think there's only a tension here insofar as you are ignoring the distinction between what is your natural right and what is your obligation as a Christian. That's where the tension is. But I think particularly Christian NCAPs, and you know, somebody could, there's a debate I did for LCI with our mutual friend Jacob Winograd on this point, on Christian pacifism from a you know, libertarian perspective. You know, it comes from a place ultimately of, I think, wanting to feel like you are in control and wanting to feel like you can defend yourself and people you care about, not just yourself, but people you care about if the need should arise. So I understand the impulse. I don't necessarily always like Christian pacifism. There are times when I think about it, it makes me feel uncomfortable because I have kids and I have a wife, and I'd like to think that I would do anything I could to take care of my family and that, you know, that I feel that I have a responsibility to do so. But the idea that there are perhaps limits to what I should consider being willing to do in order to, you know, fight off a bad guy or something like that, it's sort of scary, because you have to live in a world where God is sovereign. And it's not just about what you do. It's about whether or not you're willing to trust God enough to obey him. And that, I think, is where the rubber hits the road, because we're no longer living as secular people who are influenced by Christian morality. We are part of God's kingdom, and we belong to Jesus. And that's a scarier way to live in some way if you don't actually believe that Jesus is Lord.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that maybe my understanding of pacifism has kind of evolved over time, too. You know, you mentioned Jacob, and I love Jacob, you know, but he seems to like to debate this quite a bit. I've listened to him debate I don't know if you know Abby Kleckner, but he's debated her on it.
Yeah, I listened to that conversation before I debated him, because I wanted to understand where he was going to come from. Yeah.
Okay, good. Because she's really one who influenced me into what pacifism really, what the way she sees it and stuff. But like I said, I think mine has evolved over time, because I didn't really understand it. I mean, you're right. It will make you uncomfortable when you think about it, because I have the instinct as well, although I don't have any kids, but my instinct would be to defend them and do anything I can to protect them. It's a very tough topic to have, especially with Christians who believe that their first inclination is to grab a pistol, you know. And I think that, to me, when somebody, and I've said this out loud, and I guess I was trying to be snarky, but I think when your first instinct is to grab a pistol to defend your family, meaning you're going to harm somebody else or you're going to kill somebody else to protect your family, to me, that's very lazy thinking. I think there's other ways to restrain or stop an altercation to protect your family. If you have time, I encourage anybody to go take up the martial art of jiu-jitsu. It's one of the most peaceful ways you could end an altercation without killing somebody. You could put somebody to sleep very quickly. They're going to wake up. The altercation's over. They've never been picked up by the cops or whatever. You know what I'm saying? So when I say I think it's very lazy thinking, I don't think people really thought it through. And I've said this over and over. I mean, I grew up in gun culture in West Texas. I understand I'm not afraid of pistols. I have a pistol, but I'm just not going to use it on anybody. I just enjoy to shoot pistols. There's something very therapeutic to be able to sit out there and target shoot, you know. And I don't even hunt because I don't have the patience for it. So it's not like I'm out there learning how to shoot so I can go shoot deer and stuff, because I just don't have patience for that. I'd rather go fishing. But the whole idea that's where we're headed, you've got to first do that. Why don't we take some time to think about this first, just so you can be prepared for something that might come up? I think one thing that drives me crazy about this topic when it comes to these debates is it's almost 100% a hypothetical situation that may never happen. So that means to me that we have time to sit down and talk about this and think about, or you have sat down, not you personally, Cody, but other people listening, you've got time to sit down and think about what actually would I do. And I can sit here and tell you all day long that I've sat here and thought about it. I have thought about it. But at that time, I don't know exactly how I'd react to a situation too, because I think it's a natural instinct to defend yourself. I had a pastor one time, and he said, you know, just the whole, it's not that we fear death, but if you see it coming, it's your natural reaction to kind of defend yourself in some way, whether it's a car accident or whatever, something dropping on your head or something like that. So it's your natural reaction to preserve your life, basically. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that either, but I don't think that should mean we discount pacifism, because the way pacifism has been described to me is just working towards peace. It's peacefully working towards peace. And we saw it a lot with Martin Luther King during all that. He was very adamant about being peaceful during, you know, going against the state, you know. But I could also see at the time the way that some of these people were being treated by the state, by the cops, I could see why they would want to fight back. But I don't, and even if they were being pacifist, that was their natural reaction to being sprayed by water to fight back. I don't really have a problem with that either. I simplified it for me to where I'm not willing to kill anybody. That doesn't mean that I'm not going to hit them. That doesn't mean that I'm not going to restrain them. And I've been told too by others that that's not really pacifism if you are harming somebody. And I have a problem with that, because I don't think that's true. I'm not harming them with the intent of harming them and ending their life. If I'm harming them, it's because I'm protecting myself and somebody else. But I will stop at the point to where if it looks like I could end their life, I'm not going to do it. Even if that means me losing my life, if that means me taking the time to restrain this person while everybody else gets away, if that makes sense. I couldn't imagine, even if that person was the nastiest of all human beings, the idea of ending that person's life, I don't think I could live with something like that, knowing what we know about Jesus. And that's why I think it's important to kind of sit down and think about this. Take some time to think about this. Reach out to Cody and see what he thinks about it, you know, or talk to other pacifists, because my first thought of pacifism when I first heard it, we're just sitting on the couch doing nothing. We're not worried about anything else. But I think, to me, pacifists are way more active and working more towards the kingdom than somebody killing somebody. That's just me. And you know, if you'd have known me 10 years ago, I would have never said any of this, because I always thought you could correct bad behavior with violence. And I just don't think that's true. There's so many stories out there of people who've been gone to prison for murder, but the family refused to sign on to the death penalty, and they've forgiven this murderer, and it's changed that murderer's life to where they are seeking Jesus. You see what I'm saying? So there's stuff that can come out of that by being peaceful, by being pacifist, and it's going to change a person's life. Now, if you killed that person, they never had an opportunity to seek Jesus.
Yeah.
It's just over.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and with pacifism, I mean, I will say, there's not necessarily one size fits all. There's a range of ways of applying it or understanding it. I mean, ultimately, at the root of it is just the Latin word pax, which means peace. And so it's a way of approaching peace, of peacemaking, essentially. And there's different understandings about the best way to approach that, whether that means that you never ever raise a fist or never try to restrain somebody would be like the most extreme understanding. But yeah, I that's not where I would go either, though.
Well, there's examples of that as well, of people taking their pacifism to that extreme. And we've seen it in history. Gandhi is a good example, you know. So that's a topic that's probably going to continue to come up among these circles. That's why I like to have the conversation as much as possible. That's that portion of your book that I read. I really want to talk to Cody about this, because it's something that's going to continue to come up, especially if you got new people kind of coming into the circles and they say, oh, there's pacifists in these Christian anarchist circles. Because they do, man. They filter in. That more and more people are kind of coming into the Bad Roman Project. It's through like the discussion group stuff, and they're seeing some of these conversations where we've had these conversations a million times already, and a lot of these people might be new to the conversation. So I'm gonna have the discussion as much as possible, just so I can refer them back to the show, so they can listen to these conversations.
Yeah. And you know, there's lots of different resources people could look at, but I prepped a lot for that debate I did with Jacob. So I'd recommend that to anybody who's wanting to think through it a little bit, because I think I did an okay job of pulling the resources together and looking at the biblical text. That's one good place to start, although you've got, of course, lots of resources on it as well. And so there's lots of places people can go. I'll recommend all kinds of books, as I'm sure you can, on that subject.
Yeah, well, I don't think I got to listen to that debate. I think when y'all held it, I was at work. Y'all do a lot of stuff during the week whenever I'm working, and I don't get a chance to.
Well, the nice thing is it's recorded. So if you ever want to pull it up on YouTube, you can find it.
Hey, folks. We have set up a very simple way to donate to the Bad Roman Project through spotfund.com. Just go to Spotfund and search No King But Christ. This has become necessary to continue to provide a quality podcast and keep production costs down as well. Just $5 or $10 a month will go a long way in helping us keep this project going and continue spreading the very basic message of No King But Christ. So if you like what we were doing and can find it within your budget, go to spotfund.com and search No King But Christ, and you can set up monthly donations or even donate one time. Any and all donations help more than you know. And as always, any donations above production costs will go directly to charities in Memphis, Tennessee. Thank y'all so much. Now back to the show. All right. Well, I'm kind of being selfish about your book for me, because this is another conversation that comes up too about the American Revolution. I've thought over and over about, I haven't really thought about it much lately, but it's something that will come up again. Like we were talking about pacifism and self-defense and stuff. When it came, the more I went into, the more I studied pacifism, the more I went into, got really kind of just reading the words of Jesus. And I've said it to people who are some big supporters of the revolution. I said, there's nothing about that Jesus would support. Then I've hit with, well, what about Patrick Henry, who was, by all accounts, from among the other founders, was the most devout Christian of all of them. And he was one of the ones that kind of spearheaded this whole revolution, right? So what about that? I was like, even of all the great things that Patrick Henry said about liberty, there's nothing that Jesus would have condoned about the American Revolution.
Patrick Henry was also a pro-slavery guy.
Right.
Yeah, which just goes to show you somebody can be very pious in a lot of ways, but that doesn't mean that they're right about everything.
Well, I said, have you read the book? I didn't mean to cut you off, but have you read that book, Lion of Liberty?
No, I don't think so.
It's about Patrick Henry. And during that book, you mentioned slavery, and this is something too that when I bring that up about Patrick Henry, they're like, well, but it was legal. Like, that doesn't make it right. That doesn't make it moral. But in this book, Lion of Liberty, that was something, according to this book, it was something that Patrick Henry was very conflicted about. He didn't know what to do with his slaves. He goes, well, if I just turn them loose, they're all going to die. If I remember the book correctly, that's the way he looked at it.
Well, that could be. Well, I was going to say the revolution was illegal, so either way you get him. on the American Revolution, yeah, there's a review in my book, which is there's one larger essay on the called The Anarchist Anabaptist, and then some sort of smaller essays that add to that case or sort of reflect on it in some other context. And so I think you're referring to an article that I wrote. It's a review of David Berceau, the Anabaptist theologian, David Berceau's book, In God We Don't Trust. And he argues there that the American Revolution was an act of disobedience against God. And I agree with his case in part, but not in whole. So I think he's right that American violence was not justified, especially from a Christian perspective. But even from a non-Christian perspective, I think Berceau demonstrates, I think pretty well in that book, that British oppression has been greatly exaggerated. I mean, we were barely taxed. I think at the time of the Tea Party, was it about a 1.5% tax rate that we were?
Yeah.
that's quite a burden when you think about it from today's perspective, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we also, I mean, Americans received a number of benefits of British citizenship without a lot of the downsides. They weren't taxed as much as those who were stateside were. And in addition, those restrictions that were there, that Britain was trying to impose, were generally pretty easy to get around because there was an ocean between us and those who wanted to enforce those laws. And so, Berceau makes a pretty good case that from depending on how you want to look at it, unless you're just sort of a complete like anarchist and absolutist about having anybody rule over you at any time, even in the smallest way, I think he makes a pretty strong argument that a violent revolution was pretty extreme considering the amount of oppression that we were suffering under. Where I think that he goes wrong is that he leans, I think, too far into the idea that the state is a servant of God that does his will. Berceau, I think, leaves out or underemphasizes some important biblical data that complicates that simple vision of the state. I mean, even God's ordination of the state is not so simple. It's true that peaceful people do benefit from a just social order, but the primary purpose of the state is to punish the evildoer. So like the early Anabaptists in particular, they emphasized that the state was really a distinct order from the church, and they called it outside of the ordering of Christ, and that its purpose was to use violence to regulate non-Christians. So, you could really make the argument, I think David Lipscomb does, for example, in his book, what's David Lipscomb's book, on civil government, that ultimately government is a negative force, that it's sort of God's tool for pagans to police themselves, right? So even in the sense that God is ordaining it in some way, it's not necessarily always that he's ordaining it in a positive sense. There is a secondary benefit that's positive, which is that in an ideal scenario, Christians are going to potentially benefit from living in a society where pagan behavior is under control. But even there, it's a little bit more complicated. So there's that. There's the fact that God is ordaining it in some way, and what does that mean? But there's also the fact that according to scripture, Satan and men also have interest in the state, and that their interests are going to influence the way the state functions. So the Bible tells us that Satan is more directly in control of who's going to receive that kind of power. God's, I think, sovereignty is, I think, probably described in more of a broad sense, that God has an interest in there being a social order, not necessarily that he ordains Stalin or Hitler. Whereas Satan claims to Jesus that he actually is the one who's going to give power to whomever he chooses because it belongs to him. So Satan's influence over the state, I think, is more direct in that sense. There's also men, and men are the ones who are actually in power, and they can have good motivations. They can have evil motivations. They can do it. They can use power selfishly. They can use it to benefit others. And so, the state becomes a much more complicated sort of a machine than just to sort of say, oh, well, God's ordaining it for good. And like that's not all that the Bible has to say on that subject. And so I think Berceau reads that a little too simply into scripture and then reads that back into the American situation. And so what that I think amounts to is that disobedience to the state is not always disobedience to God. That being said, I think we're called to live peaceably with all men, to avoid casting shame on the name of Jesus. And that means that, according to the New Testament authors, we should try to obey the laws where we live whenever possible. But ultimately, we're not Americans, we're Christians. Christ is our king, so we should expect that there is going to be some conflict from time to time between the kingdom of God and the kingdoms of men. And when that happens, we're always to side with our loyalty to the kingdom of God. So what does that mean in the context of the American Revolution? Well, it certainly means that we shouldn't have been in favor of the violence, that we, I think, should have sought to make peace as opposed to go immediately into disobedience and violence. And then today, I think, kind of carrying those principles forward, I want to create a voluntary society, but first of all, it wouldn't be the right way to do it, but it also wouldn't be a very effective way to do it if I just started going around and trying to kill political officials or something. That kind of approach to making peace and having justice done is neither Christian nor is it practical. So, I have some sympathy for the ideals of the American Revolution, even though I don't think they were carried out consistently. But, there's a lot to value in that emphasis on freedom and on liberty that I think we should appreciate. But I think we also have to, as Christians, realize that it's not always about our rights. It's also about our duties as followers of Jesus.
Right. That's interesting, too. Our episode with Jeb Smith on his book, Missing Monarchy, we talked about this a little bit, too, because it's just the idea that we're better off under a democracy. The show title was Monarchy versus Democracy. And whether we're better off under democracy, which, and this is another argument too, where people are like, we're not under democracy, we're a republic. And I don't think we've been a republic for a very long time. it's moved into democracy. You know, that happened a long time ago. Was it Benjamin Franklin who said that when they got done with the ratification, that the lady asked him what they got? He goes, a republic if you could keep it. And it didn't last. I mean, it didn't last. So, I mean, the idea that we're better off now is asinine compared to what was going on then. I've often made that argument too, that, yeah, especially about taxation. We're 30, 40, 50% of our taxes, or our money is stolen from us through taxation, and it's used to slaughter people across the world. I just don't see how we're better off. And it's not, he also made the argument too, he doesn't consider himself a monarch because he doesn't want to be ruled by anybody other than Jesus. So I think that's a good way to end the show. What do you think?
Yeah, it works for me.
Good, man. I look forward to getting you back on. You do a lot of writing, so I'm sure there's going to be more opportunities to get you back on. And before I let you go, why don't you plug whatever you want to plug, and I'll let you get out of here.
Yeah. Well, let's see. There's two books that I discussed turn out yet. but if you search for my name on Amazon, you can find other books that I've written, some related to this kind of topic of sort of thinking, I guess maybe we'll say Christian theology of politics and that kind of stuff. I've got a book called Fight the Powers, which is deals with the relationship of political and demonic power, how they relate to each other. It's sort of a biblical study, biblical theology of that. I've got a short book on Christian nationalism as well, where I'm interacting with some of the major movers and shakers in that movement and their arguments and why they're wrong. And part of the idea there was to respond to it from a Christian anarchist and kind of an Anabaptist perspective, without necessarily using the words. so if you want a good take on Christian nationalism from that, at least I think it's a good take. I thought it was when I wrote it. That was the intent. And I'm going to be in the near future taking over some of the hosting duties for the Libertarian Christian podcast. So you can also catch me there and some of my articles at libertarianchristians.com.
Sounds good, man. And I look forward to getting you back on and talking about that. I've got that book, Fight the Powers, and I think that'd be another conversation to have with you. We've talked about doing it, but I just have not gotten around to it. I apologize. It's not that I don't want to talk about it. It's just,
oh, no problem.
Everything's so crazy right now, but yeah.
You're a busy guy. The one thing I will say to my benefit is if you're interested in something I'm writing about, I write short books. And so I hate reading books that are, that repeat themselves over and over again and belabor points that I, you know, if you want to hear it three times, just read the book three times.
Yeah.
So I write sort of short, concise books. And so if there's something I've written about you're interested in, you can get through it pretty quickly, I think.
Yes, you can. I was going to mention that to you too, especially with this new one. I was like, this isn't, and I think you mentioned that to me too, as well, that it's not a long book, and I don't think you've got one that is, like you just said that. So
yeah, I would try to be concise.
Well, I appreciate your time, Cody. We will do this again for sure. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Bad Roman Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show wherever you find your podcasts to never miss an episode. And while you're at it, if you like what you heard, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, it really helps people find us. 100% of donations are given to local charities in Memphis, Tennessee. To learn more about the Bad Roman Project and to find show notes, please visit thebadroman.com.
Dries Homes is not your cookie cutter home builder. We build homes to fit your life.
Great. Can we add a big laundry room with a dog wash?
Oh, absolutely.
Ooh, how about a moat?
Oh, honey.
A moat?
With a drawbridge.
Do not listen to him.
While a moat might be a stretch, Dries Homes likes your style. And for a limited time, we're offering below market rate financing to get you started on your new build.
So, no moat?
How about a man cave?
Oh, I like that.
Get started today. Visit us at DriesHomes.com. We like your style.